Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Health Minister Edward Argar joins us now. Good morning to you, sir.
Morning, Julia.
Good morning. Can we talk, before we talk about funding for hospitals and the NHS to get through the NHS winter that bodes ahead, can we talk about a little bit sooner than that, in September, just a few weeks away, schools going back? Leaked report from Public Health England on the front page of the Times today, suggesting that schools may well be pretty much safe for primary school pupils in terms of teachers and the pupils in terms of the spread of coronavirus. But older pupils, particularly as you head into sixth form age, act rather like adults when it comes to spreading infection. And there would be a bigger risk for those youngsters going back into the classroom. What do you make of those risks?
Well, I've seen that report as well, Julia. It's an unfinished report, as I understand it, unfinished piece of research, so it's too early to say what that will conclude. But what we have got are a number of international studies and international pieces of research from Australia, I think, France. We've seen schools going back in Norway and Denmark. In all of those pieces of research, and I think we had the president of the Royal College of Paediatrics yesterday on a different media outlet talking about this, and he cited a number of studies, all of which at the moment appear to suggest that children and young people have lower infection rates, lower transmission rates, and thankfully suffer less should they get this disease. So it's right that we wait to see what this report says. Every piece of scientific research into this is hugely important, but I think it's too early to read too much into a report that hasn't been finished yet.
No, fair enough. I mean, and as you say, the real world examples, many, many countries in Europe have seen no increase in infections, no cases that have been confirmed of any child infecting other children in the classroom or their teacher.
Well, that's what the evidence appears to suggest. I mean, there are some one or two schools where there are examples of small infection rates. But across Europe, across the world more broadly, that's the consensus, or that's the weight of the evidence. So we are confident that coupled with the measures we are putting in place to ensure all schools reopen at the start of term, the class bubbles, the social distancing and similar, that it is safe for pupils to go back to school. And indeed, it's very important they do go back to school, because we all know a day out of the classroom is a day's education lost.
Well, indeed. And we know the extra long term health costs for that. Well, of course, all of this does rely on a very good test and trace system, doesn't it? I mean, that's absolutely crucial. And now we're told that the government is going to be moving from its sort of centralised, circo-based test and trace service, where people sitting in a call centre or sitting at home are making phone calls to people, often unanswered and not followed up. They're going to move it now back to sort of local public health and local council teams going, you know, making those phone calls themselves, knocking on doors. In reality, isn't this exactly what an awful lot of experts called for in the beginning and said a centralised system won't work? We know what we're doing on the ground in local areas. Why don't you leave it to us? Has the government just learnt its lesson a bit too late?
Well, I think what we're seeing here, Julia, is a move. We always said this system would be flexible and would adapt, and we're seeing a move here towards, not the best choice of words perhaps, but a hybrid model where we have that central capacity, that volume, which is what we got up and running 10 weeks ago. 250,000 people who tested positive traced through that. That's 250,000 links and possible chains of infection broken. So that's played an important, hugely important part in doing this. But what we're doing is we're also recognising that the strong relationship and strong working relationships we've had throughout with local councils, we can further build on that, because you get the capacity and the scale of the national effort coupled with that local knowledge, that local community knowledge to help reach harder to reach people. This is about both bits of the system working hand in hand to make it work.
That's a great bit of spin, and I give you 10 out of 10 for that, Mr. Algar. However, last Thursday, the latest figure showed only 46% of close contacts were alerted. That's a drop on the previous week, 51%, well below the 68% mark, which we know is the bare minimum for doing it. The reality is you're changing it because the current system doesn't work. Don't you think that my listeners and everyone else in the country would be very understanding? Right, if you said, the health secretary, the prime minister just said, look, turns out, yeah, the local authorities and public health organisations were right, and actually the centralised system doesn't really work. So we're learning lessons, and we're going to do what we know will work, and we're going to change. Wouldn't that be more honest?
Well, I've already said, Julia, and you're right, I come on your show fairly regularly, and I always try to be pretty open and straight with you about this. What I think we are seeing is we have learnt from local lockdowns that as well as that volume we get from the national approach, we are also going to be using more of the local approach, which has always been there as well. It's about adapting to what works. But if you look internationally, for example, just one point on this, if you look at a lot of other countries don't publish their statistics in the transparent way we do about how this works and how we test and trace people. But of those that do, for example, I think New York has about a 42% success rate in terms of contacting people who test positive. New Zealand, of contacting people who test positive, has a few percentage points higher than us, but that's 360 people. I come back to the fact, a quarter of a million people in 10 weeks with this set up from a standing start is still a significant achievement. But quite rightly, we want to use all bits of the system that we know work, and that includes continuing to build on that partnership with local authorities and local health authorities.
OK, fair enough, fair response. So let's also talk about what the Prime Minister is going to do today. Back at the end of June, we had an announcement of extra money, £300 million to upgrade A&E facilities. And today the Prime Minister is going to confirm the 117 trust allocations of that. What exactly is this money going to be used for?
So this, Julia, is for a range of things to ensure that our EDs, our A&Es, have the capacity they need to meet both normal winter demand, i.e. In the context of social distancing and keeping people safe from COVID, but also the potential, any potential second peak at that time. So it will be spent on things like, where necessary, increasing the size of A&Es so you can get more people in socially distanced. It will be increasing the number in some A&Es of cubicles so you can treat more people, but equally treat them again in a way that doesn't bring them into contact with other people, and putting up things like, at a very basic level, things like screens and infection control measures. So it's a whole range of things. But the key here is it will increase the capacities of our A&Es so that with social distancing and infection control measures in place, people can still go there. We've been clear throughout, the emergency department's A&Es are open for business. If you need to go there, you should go there, and you shouldn't be afraid of going there. We want to reinforce that message by giving NHS Trust the money they need to further enhance those facilities for people.
OK, now, as a government minister, I must also ask you about the biggest stories this week, and that is these migrant crossings. 4,000 that we know of, more than 4,000 have crossed just this year. It's thought to be a much higher figure across the French Channel. Now, your colleague, the immigration minister, Chris Philp, is meeting in Paris today with his French opposite number. Realistically, what do we expect the French to do to tackle this issue of migrants crossing the Channel? Isn't it our problem?
Well, I think this is a shared problem. Not only is it illegal and does it need to be stopped, but also it is incredibly dangerous for those attempting it. So in their interests as well, we need to stop this these channel crossings. I've communicated this morning with Chris, a colleague of mine who is on his way to France to start those discussions. In truth, it isn't just our problem. It isn't just their problem. It's a shared problem, and we need to work together to find a solution to stop these crossings.
And it does. A lot of people would think it's rather a bit bizarre that we've got thousands of people coming in on these boats. Often we don't know where they are, where they're from, where they're going, or whether or not they're indeed got coronavirus, having lived in camps in France. And yet we are facing the prospect, possibly later this week, of countries like France, 500,000 Brits there right now on holiday, being added to the quarantine list, along with possibly Holland, Switzerland, Poland and Malta as well. How likely is it that British holiday makers could either see their holidays cancelled or face quarantine on their return?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on individual countries or decisions that might be made, but we've been very clear throughout this pandemic and since people were able to go on holiday again, that there is always a risk inherent in that, because if infection rates do go up in particular countries, as we saw with Spain, the government will quite rightly take swift and decisive action to impose quarantine to protect health and public health in this country. I'm not going to speculate on any individual countries, but as I say, people do know that while I can entirely understand how much everyone needs and wants a holiday at this time, there is always that that caution they will need to exercise, that there is always a possibility, as we saw with Spain, of a country, if it has that sort of spike, that we'll have to take action.
Online, on DAB and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Let's talk now to Dr. Leila McKay, who's my first guest today. She's director at the NHS Confederation and joins us once again. Good morning, Shilayla.
Morning, Gillian.
No, lovely to speak to you. There is an awful lot to talk about related very much to kids going back to school. I mean, we've seen these reports about parents being worried about kids going back to school and the risks. And the Public Health England report that's been leaked to the Times suggests that older pupils, the closer you get to adulthood, the more likely it is your body acts as an adult's body would. And you're more likely to catch the virus and more likely to get ill with the virus and more likely to be able to pass that virus on. Is it a very big concern within the NHS Confederation, you're representing NHS Trust, that when schools go back in September, there will be a few weeks later a big rush of people getting seriously ill and ending up in hospital? Because we haven't seen that in any other country where they've returned the kids to school.
I mean, it's clearly possible, but we don't really know. At the end of the day, there's a range of things, of which returning to school is one, that could increase the risk of transmission of coronavirus and move us towards more cases. But we don't exactly know. Certainly, we've seen other countries have quite a mixed view. In many cases, there hasn't been a spike. In some cases, just one or two children have caused quite significant little outbreaks. So It's a question that we don't really know the answer to, and clearly there needs to be some kind of balance, because getting kids back to school is of course also really important.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And again, it's about the balance of risks, isn't it? I mean, that is the absolutely crucial thing there. Let's also talk about the balance of risk in relation to test and trace, because this is absolutely very crucial. The government is apparently looking at moving away from this sort of Serco run national centralised system that's cost huge sums of money, getting people on the phone, calling people to say to them, you've tested positive, or you've been in contact with somebody who's tested positive, and can we have your contacts, etc., etc. They've tracked and traced, frankly, just simply nowhere near as many people as they need to, and it's getting worse rather than better. And there's now going to be a move from the government to move towards cutting those centralised staff and replacing them with local council teams, local public health teams, using local knowledge, not just making those calls, but knocking on doors. I mean, I have to say, this is what a lot of local health providers and local councils have been saying they wanted all along. Would you welcome that?
Yes, we would. That's absolutely right. Ever since the beginning of discussions about test and trace, we've heard from our members that the local approach is the more effective approach. People know their populations, they know their geographies, they know the so-called human geographies, and that makes it so much easier for them to target their approach and find the people. And we've seen the results, which have been that the local teams have had a higher amount of success in tracking people. That said, of course, there was a place for this national team with just the scale that we were talking here. It wasn't like local authorities had this massive amount of people in reserve ready for this. So clearly this support of having all these additional contact tracers has been really important. But now I think if we are going to make sure we do contain the virus and get the proper value from test and trace, we are actually going to have to make sure that we're tracking as many people as we possibly can. Yeah. And it looks like this is a really good move towards achieving that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the crucial thing. And again, we know the issue is an awful lot of the times that people simply aren't answering the phone. They don't have the numbers of people, they're not reaching them, or they do have the number, they call them, it's an 0300 number. People think, oh, it's just someone trying to sell me something. They don't bother answering the call. They don't leave a message. There's no number to call back on. I mean, this is such basic stuff. It sort of defies belief that it's been done on such a bad basis. Let's talk though. I mean, we do know, we know we need that to be running very well for us to get schools safely back. But we also know there is a big concern about this talk about a second wave, about the winter crisis that the NHS goes through every year, having been in crisis for much of the last year already. There's a plan now for drive-through flu vaccination centres to be set up for everybody. And I know I'm 52, so I'm eligible for that as an over 50. But people are going to be asked to go get the jabs in their GP's car parks as part of these preparations for the NHS. I mean, is that part of the answer?
It's hard to say. Our primary care members have been telling us that they really support this increase in flu vaccination, but it's quite the logistical challenge. This is vast numbers, and there are going to have to be solutions that are brought in. But what they've been telling us is we really need to make sure people aren't just getting the jab and those records are not getting back to their GPs. Everything needs to be really nicely joined up for the safety of patients and to make sure that that we're all getting the very best of care. So I think that's the primary concern, but certainly innovation is quite possibly going to be needed.
Online, on DAB and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Primary school pupils may well be very safe from the virus and keep teachers very safe because they are unlikely to pass it on or get infected. Not quite the same situation for secondary school pupils. Let's talk to Robert Helfer. He's chair of the Education Select Committee. He's also Tory MP for Harlow. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hello.
Good morning. Hello. Lots of aspects of education stories this week. But let's talk about this risk for pupils catching the virus and passing the virus on to other pupils and indeed teachers or indeed their parents from school. This Public Health England study, we haven't seen it. It's not been formally published. This is a leak, so we can't sort of ascertain how accurate it is. But it would make sense that if children are less likely to be infectious, that as they become older and closer to adulthood, they would be more likely to be infectious. So it would tally with what would make common sense. But the real life experience in other countries is that the children aren't passing this virus on.
Well, if you look at schools in almost every country apart from Israel, there have not been cases in schools in terms of children spreading coronavirus and risk to teachers. And when we weigh up these things, we've also got to weigh up the risk of children and pupils and students staying at home, suffering obesity, not having physical activity, not being able to socialise with their friends, often having safeguarding issues at home if they've got very tough domestic situations, possibly joining county line gangs, possibly being exposed to online harms on the internet if they're not being supervised. So you have to weigh up all those risks as a society. And what is better for a poor kid is to be in school, to be learning once again.
Yeah, this is the basic thing, isn't it? We're constantly told about the risk of children going to school. The reality is the risk of children not going to school. You and I have talked about this week in, week out through this. But everyone seems to ignore that aspect when they're worried about the risk of a virus.
Well, the trade unions, for example, have issued a 100-plus page document asking all sorts of questions, but not one of those questions says, what about the kids? And they, it's like as if they're on the Titanic about to sink and asking for rum rations. I mean, it's people have got to get together, work out ways that we can get our children back to school safely, because they've already been out of school for over 6 months, which is a huge time in terms of children's development.
Yeah, it is. And we know even if they miss out on 6 weeks of education over the summer holidays, we know that particularly the poorest kids, the kids who don't read a single book when they're on holidays, whose parents don't stimulate them. And again, look, may well be, yes, that they're working two jobs, they're doing their very best. But nevertheless, the kids from poorest homes tend to fall behind just over the summer holidays in a normal year, let alone 6 months off.
Well, the attainment gap, and this is the Department for Education's own figures, could be as much as 75% between disadvantaged pupils Ouch. And their better off peers by the time the lockdown ends and kids are back to school fully. We know that over 2 million children have not been learning hardly anything during the lockdown. 40%, according to an academic study, have had no contact with teachers. There's been a huge divide between those children learning and those who aren't, and often it's the left behind children who are literally left behind because they've been suffering during the lockdown with very little supervision. And not just the unions, Ofsted, I think, need to pull their finger out and do a lot more. They've sort of been in semi-hibernation during the lockdown. They should have been working with schools week by week to make sure the kids are getting adequate online learning or paper learning or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I talk about this, and especially when I tweet about this, I get a whole bunch of people saying, my other half's a teacher, or I'm a teacher, I've been working through this full time. There's no doubt at all, there are huge numbers of teachers who've done an absolutely brilliant job through this, just as many, many other people have worked their buttocks off throughout this coronavirus pandemic, through the lockdown, and done their very best for their employers and their employees. And whether they're teachers or nurses or doctors or supermarket staff or whoever, even some MPs, Robert Alfen. But there's no doubt at all. I mean, the evidence doesn't lie. I mean, that not every teacher, not every school has been doing their job. We need to face up to this.
Well, after all this is over, when we have the national inquiry about coronavirus, an important part of it has to be why millions of children have not been learning, why millions of children have had virtually no contact with teachers, why millions of children didn't have any online teaching, even when the online things were available and computers were given out. We have to find out why didn't Ofsted do more, for example, to work with schools? Why some schools been brilliant and some have done not what they should in terms of online learning? All these questions have to be asked so that it never happens again.
Absolutely. Well, look, schools are going back in September in England. They're going back starting today in Scotland over just different regions, going back at different times. This after Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, apologised for the exam grades in the Scottish Highers from last week. This after, there was, again, the same problem we had in England, where schools predicted the grades without any exams being taken, over-predicted, what a surprise, and then they've, using a computer model, they've basically downgraded. Lots of pupils expected to appeal. She's apologised. Are we expecting exactly the same problems in England come this Thursday when we get the A-level results and next Thursday with the GCSEs?
Well, a few weeks ago, the Select Committee, which I chair, published a report on this very issue, and all the surveys suggest that disadvantaged students will have their marks downgraded. In fact, only 16% of students who go to university, 16%, have the correct grades that they get predicted for. And we know that over 1,000 high-achieving disadvantaged students get under-predicted every year, according to the Sutton Trust. So I really worry about this, but I more worry about the appeals system, because at the moment, if you're a Supreme Court judge, you might be able to just about navigate the appeals system. But if you are an ordinary person who doesn't necessarily lobby their MPs every day and doesn't have access to lawyers and significant funds, I worry that the appeal system will not be fair to everyone. And we have to make sure that the appeal system is fair, but also it's got to be quick, because we know that now the Wild West of different exam boards, they may take quite a few weeks to appeal and maybe pass the cut-off date for universities. And that's unacceptable. They should be able to decide it within a couple of weeks.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.